There's a short version. There is over 60-something pages of a full version. This is the one that Will Lee wants me to give you, that is a basic college one that is 6 pages. We'll deal with my incredibly copious bibliographies afterwards.
6 pages, you say?
7, 8. Yeah, but the point is, it's a 60-page companion to this one. That's okay. What? Okay, first of all, before we get started, since it is being taped, I'm going to say in the beginning, I do not want this class to go into hoc. I do not want to get personal. I do not want to hear your personal opinions of Rav Leichel or Rav Schachter or Rabbi Carmi or Rabbi JJ or anyone else. None of those. What? No, I do not want to hear your opinions of Rav Lichtenstein or Rav Shigar or what? No, that wouldn't. We're not going to get personal on any of these. That's just a premise, and I don't have to tell you that again. No questions yet. Okay. We're going to do the various constructions of modern orthodoxy. We are going to be centering on primary texts. And there's also secondary text. We'll talk about the bibliography later in today. The course is assuming there are about 12 divergent things called modern orthodoxy, and it's somewhat based on the course that Dov Schwartz teaches at Bar Ilan, but his is almost entirely Israel-centric, with 2 subunits on America and Europe. Ours is going to be the opposite, centered on America and Europe, with some subunits on Israel. Okay, the basic requirement for the course is one that you are aware that the standard trajectory of Enlightenment, Emancipation, Orthodoxy, and Reform. There will be a final exam, a take-home midterm, meaning one of these computer things, for those who've done them before, where you have so many hours to get it back to me. One of these sort of exams that I give it to you whenever, Wednesday night, and you get it back to me by, you know, God willing, by later in the night or the next day, and a paper. The paper will be a research paper with revisions based on primary sources. There are vast collections of papers, sermons, magazine articles that are out there in the library, in the archives, in HebrewBooks.org, and that's what I want you to work on. As method, we are going to be doing modern orthodoxy as religion, theology, and intellectual history. So that unlike the versions of the courses by Dov Schwartz and Avi Revitsky, which emphasize the political, we are going to do the religious and cultural aspects. And unlike the histories of American Jewry taught by Professor Sarner, Gorach Verbitz, and Michael Stanislavski, we're going to be basically theological and philosophic, not social and institutional. So, for example, when we do Rabbi Leo Young, we're going to be talking more about his affinity to the social gospel movement in America and Haverlock Ellis, and less on the history of the Jewish Center, meaning it is on their philosophies. Okay, so let's first get started with what is modernity and why is it such a thing called modern orthodoxy? Anyone want to have any thoughts about what is modernity? Yes?
Historically self-aware humans.
Okay, historically self-aware. Okay, and therefore we are now...
We're now cognizant of the differences between us and indicator 4. We try to learn from mistakes, and depending on which way you go, you might either think you reach the end of history or you're looking on the radar.
Okay, we're either self-aware or we have a sense of autonomy. Okay, those are three Kantian definition of modernity. You should know that there's the leading selling thing that's now flying off the shelves in Sfarim stores, the Sefer called Bilvavi Mishkan Evneh, with his little Musa Sefer, which openly says you do not consider yourself as anything. You are completely in the hands of God. Came out last year. So the in Yeshiva Sefer, there's nothing that is you. There's not even Hakaras HaTov from God, because anything that you chose to do was all from God entirely. And that's in. Okay, that's one definition. Any other definitions of modernity besides self-awareness? Any other thoughts of modernity? What is modern orthodoxy?
Now is modern.
Why now? Meaning, why now? Yes.
Understand the role of the contemporary society in light of historical religion.
What does that mean?
Okay.
Okay. Yes.
I would understand the modern orthodox as just like the modern terms mean people who keep halacha, but you know, are not, as opposed to all the traditional orthodox.
As opposed to, okay, so you have this traditional world and versus a modern world. Okay, we're going to come back to that soon. Yes?
Well, like, you have to talk, I guess, about the legacy of what happened in Germany and whether German neo-orthodoxy spawned like another branch of orthodoxy as opposed to the yeshiva world and the Hasidic world inspired orthodoxy.
Okay, but what did they do in Germany?
Well, first you have rabbis who have PhDs, which is a big deal.
Mm-hmm. But what is that? Why is that different in the Middle Ages? Yeah. People, there was the Rambam.
That's just an undifferentiated traditional community. That's just like, that there's no orthodoxy reform or anything. There's just a traditional community.
Okay, so it's now differentiated.
Go ahead.
Yes?
Yeah. I think an essential element of era, and specifically modern orthodoxy, the ability to actually confront the other, angle with the other, and choose to do things the way you do them,
mm-hmm.
reject some otherness, as opposed to, I guess, that gentleman's conception of traditional orthodoxy, who really isn't at all in contact with the other, just sort of has a stereotype of the other, and can't really engage.
Okay, well, I'm now going to give you a whole bunch of theories. Almost everything you said is incorporated, but let's put them on the table because we're going to use them in evaluating what makes modern orthodoxy modern orthodox. First, the idea that there's a traditional society versus a new society based on secularization. And I'm going to give you three versions of this. The first one is that there is a change and a breakdown for what's in the past. The leading proponent of that would be someone like Hegel. There was a Middle Ages. There is now the Enlightenment. Napoleon is the Enlightenment on horseback. It is a new era. There's a breakdown of the former worldview. It's also held by Durkheim. We now live in an age where there's a breakdown of the traditional patterns. And in this worldview, it's inevitable that we are all part of this breakdown, this change, the end of tradition. And there has to be a rejection of the past. Besides Hegel and Durkheim, you'll find Jack Wertheimer going in that direction. You will find Sam Heilman going in that direction. And you'll find early Martin Marty going in that direction for American religion. A second variant of the secularization thesis is the one popularized by Max Weber that says, yes, there is a change of modernity, but it then leads not to a breakdown, but to a transformation. There is a transformation that occurs in that no longer are you unconscious traditionalism or the way things were, but you reorganize yourself in a brand new way. The leading proponent of that in Jewish studies is Jacob Katz, who differentiates between traditionalism, in which there was an undifferentiated sense of tradition, versus now the rise of orthodoxies in Germany, in which there is now a self-conscious identification as part of a given movement called orthodoxy. So there was a breakdown and then a transformation into something new called orthodoxy, and Jacob Katz would say orthodoxy is a 19th century movement because it's self-conscious of continuing against secularization. A variant of model number two was by a colleague of Max Weber, Ernest Troeltsch, who gave a series that there were a number of other reactions one can have besides self-consciousness. And the one that's going to concern us in this course is Troeltsch could also say you can create a sect. And Troeltsch's example would be Amish or Mennonites. They are modern, even as they walk, have horse-drawn buggies, and only wear homespun cloth, is because they're consciously sectarian in a modern age. And the way to apply that would be Satmar or early Lakewood would not be traditional. They are also in their own way modern in the fact that they are now sectarian. They have to go out of their way to be sectarian in an age when nobody else is doing the same things they're doing anymore. Model number three of secularization, and this one has only been around for about the last 10-12 years, says that secularization is a completely independent ideology that makes possible science, tolerance, liberalism, and rather than there being binary pair of before and after of tradition versus secular, is that many people have certain percentages of both. I mean, secularization is not the opposite of religion. Secularization is saying, oh, when I now do politics or economics, I wear my secular hat. When I go home to my family, I'm putting on my religious hat. And that they are different modes. Some people associated with, this one is yet to make it into Jewish studies. Some of the people associated with would be like Talal Asad's recent book on secularization, or Lee Clow's book on emancipation, saying that secularization is a clear ideology, but there's no before and after. It's a specific additional element you have. Yes?
In this third model, the person was in the workforce
The answer is they would not see it as mutually contradictory. They would just say it's a mode you adopt. You can adopt two contradictory modes in your same life. And where the line is, that's where it's going to, people are start going to use it. Everyone who takes this are now the new theoreticians who think that there never really was a before and an after. But you can have both at the same time.
One last thing about that.
Yes.
So when transmitting that, this dual, mm-hmm.
Second approach, which I'm going to give, which I'm going to call not secularization but modernization, the modern era, and I'm going to give you four variants of this one. Okay, the modernization, instead of focusing on a before and after of religion, focuses on the social and demographic upheavals, the rise of mercantilism, the rise of urban life, the rise of new technologies. And this model says peasants became citizens. We have the rise of printing press. We have the rise of urbanization. Not that there was any religion to secular, but religion just had to respond to this process of modernization. The leading proponent of this was Professor Eisenstadt, the sociology professor at Hebrew U, that religion adopts to these new changes, but there's nothing intrinsically religious or secular about these changes. A second variant of this is what's called the dependence theory version of it. It says that modernity came from the outside and religion has to confront modernity. So it's not like saying Jews moved to urban Warsaw or urban New York and therefore they part of the change was their urbanization. There's a confrontation going on between the religion and modernity, and is a clear sense of dependence. One upon, meaning religion has to be dependent on outside forces. And this one is less of an academic theory and more the way you're going to find it described in a lot of the popular literature or in people's memoirs. You know, the modern city overwhelmed me type of approach. What? Unless anybody on the Lower East Side speaks in that tone, rather than saying that you're going from pushcarts to a clothing store to manufacture, that you yourself are actually part of this process. But in many memoirs, you see yourself as dependent. A third variant on this one is in with sociologists who will talk about the social world you inhabit within modernization, and a lot of the reasons we do things will have nothing to do with ideology. They will have to do with nostalgia, convenience, creating a good place to raise our families. And that a lot of modernization of orthodoxy has a lot to do with decisions of where you want to live, less to do with what sort of modernization you want, and less specifically bigger questions. The final form, the fourth version of this, and this one I want you to understand, has a fancy name called the subaltern perspective. Subaltern means not subliterate. And this one comes from the study of Asian cultures and peasant cultures, that a lot of times peasants will do things that seem modern for their own reasons and sometimes even anti-modern reasons. Most of the literature deals with the Indian subcontinent or Indonesia, meaning if a region in the Indian subcontinent, you find the illiterate group is now using modernity, but you can find they're not doing it to be modern. A lot of times they're doing it either to help their coconut crop or in order just to keep the politics outside of where they are. They have no modern agenda. Examples of this in the Jewish context is a lot of times things could be done in Orthodox or Yeshiva context, and things could seem very modern, but you're not doing them for modern reasons. You'll see a lot of that in the studies of Eli Letterhandler on the rise and modernity of Russian Jewry, that even if the rabbis are using something that seems modern, don't mistake it for a modernist agenda. They're using it for their own reasons. So this is all part of the modernization, meaning yes, what? No, that's a bad example. But there's a lot of things in terms of technology or media or printing or mercantilism that you can see that a rabbinic group will start using with no agenda of saying, oh, my goal is to become more modern. They're using it for their own practical limited needs. Like, what? Right. Okay? So a lot of that part of it, that's a real part of the definitions here, and that people have studied it, and most of the theory on that was done not on Judaism. It's really actually not made it to Judaism too much yet. Meaning, the only one who actually was sensitive to it was actually Solomon Pohl in his book on Satmar, is that when they went back to B&H Photo, when Satmar was now saying you have a Shabbos clock, they weren't doing it to be modern, to use this phrase Shabbos clock and use technology. They were doing it for their own internal reasons. But Pohl, back in whatever it was, 1960, didn't have the terminology for what that phenomena was that he was trying to describe. Now there's a whole literature of books that describe that phenomena, and that's important for us to understand that every Satmar Chassid that runs a photo store is not modern Orthodox, but there's a language for how to distinguish it. Yes?
How does that compare to Model 1 in this?
Because Model 1 assumes that we're all part of this big process and we modernized and we're reactive. Here, as you may have not even modernized, you're just using some small fragment out of context for whatever way, some of even in a counter-modern way. Because, okay, so B&H was a bad example. An example would be when Ellie Letterhandler shows you that the rabbinate in Vilna was putting up posters to look like the same way the socialists were putting up posters. On one hand, you could say it's a modernization of the way the rabbinate is communicating with the people, and now posters have a whole life in Me'ez Sharim of putting up posters. But on the other hand, that's not an act of modern. That new form of media is in some way, at the very moment it's being used to counterbalance modernity or to sidestep it.
So maybe email, debate, Torah.
Okay, so these are things that are going to play themselves out. I'm giving you some vocabulary by which to think about the topics. Next. Functionalism, this is number 3. Functionalism. Functionalism and here we have much more of the airs of Durkheim and Franz Boas and other early sociologists who believe that religion lost its meaning in the modern era. Peter Berger's terms, it lost its ability to serve as a sacred canopy. One couldn't use the old ways. One couldn't continue one shtetl life in America. But as soon as you reorganized in order for it to serve the needs again, then it did. And the people who work on that will now be Peter Berger's descendants, like Christian Smith, Robert Wuffnow and others, who show the rise of evangelical religion and Mormons and others in America, is showing whatever functionalism it lacked in the 1920s, it once again had religion is completely functional to everybody, and therefore it's in again and it's increasing in its strength. So unlike the modernization model, which assumed that there were real structural changes, and unlike the first model that assumed secularization happened, this just assumed that there was some reason of a temporary lack of functionality, and it's functional once again, and it's doing well. Fisk and Glock from Princeton go one step further and say that a certain people will be attracted to religion whenever it functionally offers them a lot, and therefore the rise of strong religious communities in America, whether the Frum community or a lot of the religious Christian communities, is because they give you a very strong functional payback in community solidarity of helping you raise your kids, of helping you when you're sick and other times. And there's a real need for it at that time. And nothing to do with modernity. And they will actually show you 300-400 years that after that, you know, Kant or Hegel or anyone else did not produce any lulls. It had more to do with the social structure of a given time period, whether religion is going to be on the ascendancy or not. That's model number 3. Model number 4 is our philosophic model, which I'm going to give you 3 versions. The first philosophic model was the one that Mr. Blickstein started with, the Kantian model, what is enlightenment, what is Aufklärung. The Kant answer was self-awareness, autonomy, using human reason. And for many self-conscious versions of modern Orthodoxy. That was the goal, is to say we are self-aware, we have autonomy. Or the second version of this is a question of faith and reason, responding to the intellectual challenges of modern thought, whether biblical criticism, historicism, Darwinism. A third version of this assumes that there's an eternal religious type that combines religion with philosophy, religion with the highest level of culture, and that it's a constant struggle throughout eternity between your Augustines and Tertullians, between your Aquinas's versus your Visigoths, between your Pietists and your theologians. And it's a continuous struggle to be a Maimonidean, to have this cultured religion. Someone who's Jewish who has that is Ben Sasson. In his Jewish history, he takes that approach of assuming that rationality always had to find its way. So does Professor Twersky took that approach, that it's always a pro-Maimonidean versus a non-Maimonidean approach within society. Yes? That's doing it in a very narrow sense, but it's assuming it's a continuous struggle between the... They're identifying modernism with intellectualism, with philosophy, with sophistication, and whatever our struggles are in 2005 were the same in 1940, were the same in 1230, were the same in 600. There's one constant... And we're going to see versions of that, of people who are praising the same way. We're going to have, Philo, Maimonides, Hirsch, as being this continuous same pattern that we're playing out. Yes?
The people who take the philosophical approach, won't the number of modern Orthodox people always be, really small?
For all of these three models?
Yeah. Because you're saying that you want,
Okay, so the answer is, for model number three, for Professor Twersky, the answer was yes, and he was an elitist. However, there are many out there in the community that assume that why can't everybody be like that? For position number one, and this is really the one of philosophy, the autonomy and self-awareness, whether we are in the 1830s or the 1960s, there are moments in history when everybody thinks we're all becoming aware, we're all becoming autonomous. So, for example, the first topic discussed in the Orthodox form, when the very first one met, the topic was autonomy. Because coming out of the 60s, people believed we're now all autonomous beings. So there's a certain blurring of the lines between model number one, we're all now autonomous beings, and model number three is we're all intellectual beings.
Like a pathological condition in the first model?
Careful.
I'm afflicted with self-awareness, I'm aware of myself, or is it like I can afflict myself if I so choose with this self-awareness?
No, I think they're assuming that it's a natural sense that we have to own up to.
Our whole world around us forces us to be...
That's right. That's right. My fifth model, which I'm going to call the national or political, and let me explain this one, because this one exists the least in American scholarship, and this will be important for understanding German Orthodoxy. Within, this exists much in the Catholic material. Within Catholic modernity, whether France, Germany, Italy, there was a debate. Are you a citizen of your state, or are you a member of your religion? Which takes precedence if push comes to shove? And specifically, if you live in Germany or France, do you follow, are you more of a German or are you more of a Catholic? This broke out in the 1860s in Germany, and it was called the Kulturkampf, the culture war, between which takes precedent, religion or nationality. Some of the practical differences, do you have more connection to your co-religionists in another country? Or do you have more connection to your co-nationalists of a different religion? Okay, this broke out in the 1860s within the Christian world. Other examples is, if you are a nationalist, then you care about all national products, even if they were made by secular people. If you are taking the religious approach, you are saying, no, I exist in a transnational identity, and I don't care about the secular products. Hold on. This will also play itself out between the role of clergy versus laity. All modern nationalisms believe in laity and being a citizen, while most of the defense of the Catholic Church at the end of the 19th century played itself out, I trust clergy over laity. It plays itself out in who gets to speak in the community. And we're going to come back to this when we do German Orthodoxy, because a lot of their polemics were played out against the culture comps that were going on within the Christian community within Germany and elsewhere. Okay? So this is a completely different model. There's a new book. I mean, I'm going to return a whole shelf of books to the library next week. But there's a book that just came. What? No, only the ones that's together in the last few months. Okay. This stuff is beginning to make its way into American scholarship. There's a new book that came out called Cultural Wars, dealing with the 1860s and the importance of these questions for understanding modern religion. So once again, rather than it being an inevitable, we now live in a secular age, this approach says we are choosing nationalism over religion. This one will play a big role also in many of our Israeli models that will say we choose Zionism and caring about all of Klal Yisrael over whether they're religious or not. And therefore a secular person building the state plays more of a role than somebody who isn't. I don't want to go into the details now, but you see the importance of these theories. And there are a lot of, for example, Rabbi Isaac Breuer's defense of Orthodoxy is going to be played out against this backdrop of the culture con. My final model, number 7. Number 6. And this one I'm going to have two versions of. The first version is a standard one, is the buying into the modern scientific cosmology, meaning we now accept doctors, modern science. We don't assume, we assume a great deal of ordinary biology, physics, chemistry. We don't go looking for the seven heavens anymore in a scientific way. And for most people, these were live issues between 1770 and 1810 for most intellectuals. For many, it didn't become an issue until people went to school in 1910 or 1920 when they first went to public school. And there are others who had to wait till 1969, to the moon landing, in which it became something to have to talk about. But I'm not going to take questions yet, because the real version of this is the second version, which I'm going to call de-Christianization. And this is an approach associated with figures like Michel Vauval and Le Goff and Ladore, that says that in the 18th century, people were concerned about death, the other world. People knew you would die in childhood. Death rituals were common. A lot of discussions were about the other world, Kabbalah, mysticism. And all of that really died. You can almost pinpoint to a decade in a given country. So in Italy, it's going to die around 1770s. Even in the yeshiva circles within Russia, it'll die in the 1820s and 30s. When people no longer think about death, olam haba, the journey of their souls, and start thinking in this worldly psyche terms. And I'm going to be using that as my starting point, as you'll see why, for really a shift in culture between the early modern world of 1500 to 1800 that was very concerned with the soul, to now this new world that's concerned with this worldly concerns. And Michel Vauval wants you to be quantified, not to speak in abstractions, meaning let's do studies of tombstone art, let's do studies of eulogies, let's do studies of sermons, and actually see, as the decades go on, how the content changes. Meaning rather than models one through one and two, which assume a before and an after, especially number one assumes a before and an after, this model doesn't assume any before and after. This is like saying, okay, I'm getting Kabbalah and the Gra, I'm getting Yisrael Misalant, now only talking about my Kochas Akechen, I'm now getting the Alta of Slobodka, not using any of those terms. I am now, I'm watching the terms and I'm really going decade by decade of how the early modern concern with death, the soul, and the afterlife change. And this approach assumes that it changed because we don't die young anymore. We assume we're going to live. And because we've adopted a scientific worldview that has superseded a great deal of this early modern worldview. Vauval, V-O-V-E-L-L-E. We only have one book of his in the library in English. How is your French? What?
Not so good.
Okay. There's one book that he's called Mentalities and Ideologies, and you can get a summary of his approach, at least in one of those chapters. Okay, yes.
Wouldn't the corollary of that approach be that people started dying again and the discourse would shift?
Yes.
Did that happen?
Yes, that would really be that. That would be one of the things that depending that how much we are tied in to disease and health and those things will affect the nature of the religion.
You mean like the Holocaust would pull out of it, probably occasion a shift back to that kind of language?
Actually, it didn't. Is that that for you? But this approach would ask, what is it that's causing the shifts? But this one wants to deal on the intrinsic science ones. But one can make the analogy over. Yes?
Wouldn't there be people who would like to read into history that there existed in the 1500, 1800 era scientific approach, meaning not in the position where, because we lack that now, that there was a pro-science back then, therefore?
There was a pro-science, but until Germany 1920s, whether you saw a doctor or didn't see a doctor, really it was a 50-50 shot one way or the other, and it wasn't that true in America till the 40s. Meaning the growth, what a doctor could do or what science could do, was limited for a good portion of the... whatever science did do in the early modern period, it was experimental science for these scientists in the laboratories. It didn't affect people's basic cultural worldviews. Yes?
Which
ones? It's the people. Okay? Okay, now if you move on, go back to your syllabus. On the third page of this package, this is the basic models we will be doing. We will talk about the non-ideological traditionalists, first in Italy, then England, then in America, and how those countries created their versions of modern orthodoxy, which I'm calling traditionalism. Well, the second one is religious Zionism, and it's really starting with how Rav Reines and his intellectual descendants thought things have to change. And they're essential for understanding a lot of the basics of building the American institutions. We are then going to look at the more polemical culture comp Germany. And then and only then will we talk about then why was Germany different than every other country. What was going on there that it reached such acrimonious states? And why did it splinter the way it did into groups, which didn't happen in other countries? Then, number four, modern Orthodoxy, which is a very clear movement out into suburbia of urban Jews post-World War II, and what was their agenda. Then the new world of centrism. A brief moment, there isn't very much to do on open Orthodoxy, but we will talk a little bit about some of why that's functioning as a reaction to centrism. Then the Israeli models of Kibbutz Adati. Then the state religious Zionism. Then the world of the Rav Kook and his followers. And now the new religious movements. Then this is actually not the order. We're probably going to do America first. Then we're going to talk about some of the issues of NCSY, Torah, Mesorah, Chafetz Chaim, some of the modernizing that went in on what we call the more modernish side of within America, followed by now the professional Aguda, you know, our Aguda Nick Yeshiva graduate who now goes to law school. Where do they fit into this? And Chabad is a modernist movement. Okay. Now, in terms of definitions for modern Orthodoxy. Modern Orthodoxy was only used as a term by those rabbis post-World War II, meaning it was only those RCA rabbis who used the term modern Orthodoxy. No questions yet. So in terms of the word Orthodoxy, we are going to see that the world of traditionalists are going to only use the word orthodox as a theological position within a spectrum of philosophic positions. But it's not referring to people. Orthodoxy will be used in Germany for those who fought the reform movement. They are then going to start being called orthodox. And then it will be used by, like I said, post-World War II, modern Orthodox will use it. Israelis use the word religious Zionism. They don't use the word modern Orthodox. And only recently have they started. And even, you know, as recently as President Belkin would only use the word traditionalism, because there was enough of a chasm between what he thought was reform and traditionalism that just saying you were traditional spoke for itself. The word modern, what I want you to pay attention is, besides all the criteria that I gave you, modern is usually only used by somebody who thinks there's a non-modern element. And that's a big part of the rhetoric of modern Orthodoxy, is always saying, ha ha, there's somebody out there who's not modern. And this plays a role first in Germany, between what quote-unquote neo-Orthodox versus what came to be called the ultra-Orthodox. It played a role in America as a dividing line between the yeshiva world and that post-World War II modern Orthodoxy. In Russia, the word modern took on a whole different, with Rabbinus and religious Zionism, took on a whole different concern, because there it meant somebody who was concerned with the economics and political needs of the laity. It didn't have, it was not about fighting reform or fighting people religiously to the right. Modern meant help answering the needs of the post-1881 Jewry. For religious Zionists, the word modern means building a state, being part of the army. Okay, modern also tended to mean in most of these places accepting a middle class lifestyle, certainly in the diaspora, rabbinical schools that produced modern rabbis. Many of these institutions or places we're going to talk about are going to be hybrids. For example, Yeshiva University that could have go back to 1926, that could simultaneously, or to make my life easier, let's go to 1950, that can simultaneously have an Eastern European yeshiva, religious Zionists, or some members of it, to have some members who are religious Zionists, some members who are traditionalists, and some members who are modern Orthodox. Do not assume that any institution, shul, or anything is ideologically consistent. You will have congregations in which the rabbi, the assistant rabbi, and the ed director will have three divergent philosophies. What? Fine. But the point that I'm trying to make is, since this course is not on institutions, but is on philosophies, what you will see is that many times you will have multiple ones going on in the same institutions.
What is the manual labor?
Manual labor, because for many in Israel, being modern meant Torah v'avoda. We don't believe now in the old approach of only Torah. We believe in kibbutz adati. We have to settle the land. We have to drain swamps is as important as learning. Yes. Let's go through this. Let's just do the setup. Okay, a few other points before we get down to the syllabus. My own position in terms of coming to teach this course is I come from the other direction, having taught Hasidut and Mitnagdut for many years, living in the world between 1770 and 1820, and then realizing that it's not the world of modern Orthodoxy, is I'm coming from the dissonance going from the other direction of saying that a lot of the Magid of Rav Liakov, of the Magid of Mezrich, and the Nefesh Chaim of Chaim of Elezhin is not the world of today. So it jarred me more than most. And partly is I was very conscious of how the ideas of Chassidut and Mitnagdut modernized, whether in Reb Tzadok, whether in Yisrael Misalant, in various figures, so I'm much more conscious of this slow process. Two, this is in general what I do even in the Italy course, of separating out between 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th century philosophies. So therefore, I'm less seeing things as a before and after, because I have a much richer before. It's not some vague Middle Ages. I have a very clear sense of what century I am in any given day. The next is, do not assume from the syllabus or anything else what specific side I am on, because I am not arguing for medieval positions or Hasidut or Mitnagdut in this course. I have found many times in people reading people's notes that they reflect the most the interest of the person taking the notes. So many times, for example, I have great sympathy, for example, for Rav Aaron Cutler, and you will never see that in the notes because most of the students who are in my courses have less interest in it. On the other hand, you'll see they'll write 3 pages on Rav Yishaya Leibowitz, even if I spoke about him for 5 minutes, because the person taking notes had a great interest in that topic, because I'm personally interested in Machshava, or something we're going to get to next week, Shadal. Shadal will reject philosophy and Kabbalah. He will reject all medieval exegesis. We will spend quite a bit of time on him as one of the building blocks for a modern orthodoxy. But do not assume that I am on Shadal's side. I am much more looking to try to figure out what do we do with the traditional materials. So that's one thing to bear in mind. Okay, the reading list. Now, turn to the next pages. This is the first two-thirds of the reading list. Anything that doesn't have a statement otherwise next to it is already on CD and will be up on the website. What? No. I don't know what's the... It'll be on YU Torah with the lectures for this class. Anything that is copyright protected will be on e-reserve, but there's only about 3 articles that fit that. Other than that, this list of material will all be readily available. We can make copies even of the CDs for all the material. The way this is going to work, is that there's going to be, once again, the take-home midterm, and it may be a take-home final also. Those who've done those with me before know what this is. So however you want to both either divide it and work it out, some of this will be my material that I'll use in class. Some of this will be stuff that'll help you answer the questions for exam. So in traditionalism, we're starting Shadal, then we're moving into England, Chief Rabbi Adler and Chief Rabbi Hertz. Then moving to America, Rabbis Elisa, Jung, Herman Wolf, Rabbi Lichtenstein, Trudy Weiss-Rosmarin. Okay, the only things within traditionalism is I'm not giving you free copies of Jonathan Sachs's book, but everything else there will be on the website. When you, religious Zionism, the under Rav Reines, the whole mission of a holy yeshiva leader is not on the web because that is in Mendes Flor Reinhardt's. So for the copyright, I think most of you own Mendes Flor Reinhardt's. It is in there, the Jew in the modern world. Okay, everything else will be on the list. And this is going to be a crucial thing for understanding even the very curriculum at YU will be debated within this unit. Unit 2.5 is, even though religious Zionism was the major thing, there are 600 Eastern European rabbis who came to America. Many of their svarim are now in HebrewBooks.org, and they're going to have lots of different philosophies. We will briefly touch on Rav Chaim Hirschenson's Malki Bekodesh as a path not taken. But there'll be lots of other interesting figures like Binyamin Fleischer, the web-based Medrash HaGadol on the Lower East Side. I mean, lots of people other than the religious Zionist path that were out there that are paths not taken that you should know about for those of you who are interested in your paper topics. Then we are going to move back to Germany. Okay, Judaism Eternal, the Rav Hirsch articles are not on the web, neither is Korev, neither is Diane Grinfeld's Introduction to Korev, nor is Breuer's Concepts of Judaism. So those are basic and those are long. That's the longest readings are going to be Diane Grinfeld's Introduction to Korev, and number 9, Mordechai Breuer's Tradition Within Modernity. So if you're looking for anything now to start reading that is not just a few pages or an interesting text, those two are it. and I will be spending more of the time not rehearsing the basics of Rehersh, but going through where does he fit into our issues and some of the things you're not aware about. Then we will come to modern orthodoxy in its expanded form, which will include Rabbi Zelkin, Donen, Berkowitz, Rackman, Wurzberger, Spiro, Roth, Early Lamb, Maurice Lamb, and articles from Jewish Life. There's a lot of stuff out there on the web. Okay, under secondary literature, numbers 2 and 3, number 2, I didn't give you any clear pages, but for a lot of you who are interested in questions like, what was it like to be a chaplain? What was it like to come back in 46? What were the issues in 57? What were the issues in 61? Martin Marty's book will give you a very quick, whatever you need for your midterms, finals, and papers. And I want you to read James Hudnitz Bulmer's Looking for God in the Suburbs, because for a lot of you who are grappling with what was the agenda of modern orthodoxy, what were they thinking? That book will give you a broader insight. We then will spend a moment commercial on Unit 4.5, as the years of the 60s and 70s had major changes. So we will be looking at the debates between Rabbi Yitz Greenberg and Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein and commentator, the debates between Yitz Greenberg and Danziger and Jewish Observer, where the idea of Klal came to be, the Jewish Observer's critiques of modern orthodoxy, and then how almost all of those editors of Jewish Observer then became the editors of Jewish Life and Tradition in the 80s and 90s. We'll deal then with the Rabbi Riskin's agenda, dealing with the issues of why religion emptied out and then reestablished itself. You would want to look at Robert Wapnow's After Heaven. I'll give you some pieces of both Meir Kahana and Yidi Mandelbaum's book on Holy Brother and Shlomo Carlebach, both of them expressing some of the issues that changed modern orthodoxy in the 60s and 70s. Unit 5 on centrism, when people came back to orthodoxy in the 80s. We then have Nefesh HaRav is not on the web, nor is Rav Lichtenstein on the web. But the other ones, Norman Lamb is president, Rav Bleich, Rav Meir Tversky, Rav Carmi, the Torah Mada Journal, are certainly on the web. I put handout, but I will eventually put on e-reserve Christian Smith's part of his book on the rise of American evangelicalism and the return to the religion in the last 20 years, and Alan Wolf's The Opening of the Evangelical Mind, the issues, and then finally Open Orthodoxy, which is a brief unit because there isn't very much yet. Then I will give you, depending on our timetable, I will then give you a syllabus for the second half on Rav Soloveitchik, Engaged Yeshivish Chabad, Torah Avoda, State Religious Zionism of Tzvi Yehuda, and the New Religious Zionist. Questions on this? Yes?
How much time do you expect to spend in Michigan?
I think it's really up to you, and that's why I didn't give the second half. Part of it is, since the papers will mainly be on American and diaspora orthodoxy, the two-thirds of the course will be on that first half, so to speak. And since most of you will be doing papers on these things, it depends on the direction of your paper topics, who you want to work on. We'll talk about that next class, about the paper things. There's a gold mine in the archives here in New York, in the various libraries. You can get everything that everybody of these figures wrote. You can continue, some of you may want to continue papers you started with me in earlier classes. Any of the directions are fine. And I'm going to really leave it to you, what interests everyone in terms of the directions we go in. Okay, questions on any of that? Okay, what issues are we going to look at? Let me find my list of issues here. Yes? Okay. I have a list of basically 20 things, 20 factors that define a modern Orthodox rabbi, congregation, Jew. The first seven are accepted by all varieties of modern Orthodoxy. The next 13 are subject to dispute. These are not in the order of importance, and many of the disputed ones are sometimes more important than the basic seven that everyone agrees on. Okay, let's go through this. Number one, modern Orthodoxy has to accept that there is no longer a kehillah or political autonomy anymore. And whether it was dissolved in 1804 in Russia and completely banned in 1844, or the fact that America never created a kehillah, or the new European kehillahs that were then set by France, England, and Italy, you no longer have the autonomous halachic kehillah of the 17th and 18th century, nor do you have autonomous political authority. So even if you're arguing for it, you still are arguing for it. It's not an automatic given the way it was in 1700 Italy or Poland. Two. Political authority. Political, meaning if you committed a tort in 1700, you went to a bezin.
So it's ecclesiastical specifically, or
it could even be any of it. Just the judicial and governing body was... Okay, now let me get through the list first. Two is the acceptance of a scientific worldview. All forms of modern Orthodoxy accept it. It's one of the dividing lines. Three, a sense of Jewish peoplehood. That's going to be much slower in coming, but as it went on, it became almost a definitional. Four, an integration on some level of general culture. In whatever means, whether you see it as a synthesis, as enculturation, as a combination, but some amount of it. Five, an amount of westernization, embourgeoisement, suburbanization, or becoming a collective worker. Meaning the social process of whether becoming bourgeois in Europe, or suburban in America, or a worker if you're a religious Zionist, is part of the universal definition. Six, accepting that the Torah is divine. You will not find any of the forms of modern Orthodoxy denying that. And finally, number seven, the need to produce modern rabbis who have to reach the people. You will not find any versions saying we want irrelevant rabbis. Now, because your questions are guaranteed probably having to do with the 13 things in dispute. Yeah?
Why would you consider the producing modern rabbis to just people with an ascendant Jewish peoplehood?
Would I?
Why would you include the producing modern rabbi, certainly you have to produce the people, with the understanding of the ascendant Jewish peoplehood?
Because peoplehood is the whole idea of now saying we're a globalized people and therefore we fight anti-Semitism, for example, on a global scale.
Right.
Now the 13 disputed ones. One, the various roles that the Bible, Agadita, philosophy play within the curriculum. Two. Well, this is really eight. If that was eight, I know if how you want me to 13 disputed, or should I continue? On my page, I have them eight through 20. Okay, nine. How much there is a rejection of the yeshiva world, both in authority and Torah study. Different variations of modern Orthodoxy are much more rejectionist of the yeshiva world. Other versions play very nicely with the yeshiva world. And you'd be surprised who's on what side. Many of the traditionalists in Western Europe were very pleasant, were very easygoing in dealing with the yeshiva world, much better than some of those in polemical situations. 10, the role for the laity and how much the laity and the folk get a voice. 11, the dealing with contemporary issues, whether gender, the suffragette movement, temperance. And I all picked issues from the 20s and 30s rather than issues from the 2004 election. 12, the role of the building of the State of Israel. 13, the role of individualism and personal autonomy. 14, the importance of modern Hebrew. 15, the need to grapple with modern philosophy. No, because that's the thing, is how much machshava. Meaning, for example, the role of the Tzvi Yehuda Cook, they will say you should spend a lot of your time studying machshava, and you should always do the Bagrut in machshava, but they don't do any modern philosophers. Well, here, right. You know, while here there are more people, you know, let's say in some forms of modern orthodoxy that will know about Kant and know very little about the Shemona Prokhim. Next will be the attitude toward Gentiles. What attitude? I mean, how much Orla, very Orla Goyim, or integration, but where with different attitudes. Next, number 17, that was 15. 17, the role that historic and sociological data can play within a traditional discussion. And we'll be seeing that, a lot of that, the debates over that. 18, the role of historic study in the study of Jewish texts. I mean, the whole role of the academic study of Jewish texts. 17 would be the fact is taking in things like sociology within your very Jewish arguments. An example is of Hershenson, a path not taken, would say, I'm going to now want to deal with Americanization, while 18 is the extent of how much we want, you know, to study Jewish history or critical Bible as a method within our rabbinical school. 19 will be educational vision and curriculum for your elementary and high schools. 20, approaches to halakha, which should not be done in terms of simplistic terms of mekel versus machmir, but in terms of what is the canon, what is the method of limud, proportion of halakha versus gemara. Okay. Those are the basics. Because of my own inclinations, we are not, and because of the nature of this course, we are not doing the political ones, meaning number one, or the State of Israel, or modern Hebrew. I can refer you to books by Dov Schwartz, Avi Ravitsky, and others who give the version of this course dealing with those. We are going to be spending more time on numbers 8, 9, 10, 11, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, the more intellectual ones, the more cultural ones, the ones that play a bigger role within the diaspora. Okay. Now, when you are dealing with this material, I'm finishing up in a few moments, what I'm going to ask you is, I said they all integrate some general culture, but the role is, how do they integrate it? Begrudgingly, happily, Do they have a bifurcation, or do they want to be expansive? Do they think they're doing a tikkun or a correction for a past? In what way is general culture playing a role? Two, what is their relationship to the becoming part of the general culture, bourgeois, suburban? Is it one of cognitive dissonance, compartmentalization, natural osmosis? Those are some of the questions we will be asking. Or how is tradition maintained and retrieved? Memory, continuous community, book knowledge, an idea of a Masorah. In what way are you maintaining this connection? And finally, and the one that bothers me that I don't have the answer is, how much of modern Orthodoxy is by its own nature transitional or tikkun, meaning how much of modern Orthodoxy was forged by people rejecting what they grew up with to become more liberal, or how much of it is people who were raised liberal who are then later going to reject it in order to bring more Torah into it? How much of this very process, for many of these forms, is going to be transitional, that we're going to watch that almost a generation after many of these forms, the forms themselves are going to have to change? Is it because things are always changing? Or is there going to be some inherent reason that these are transitional moments? Okay? And to summarize it in the last 2 minutes, where there's in one of his paid ads in the Jewish Week, Marvin Schick criticized Jonathan Sarna's book on American Jewry, that it was too institutional, dealing with conservative, Orthodox, and Reform. And Marvin Schick wanted it now to deal more with the role of education. In this class, we are going to be dealing with three elements. One, the role of religion, and less dealing with Orthodoxy versus Reform, but more where does Orthodoxy fit in terms of Chief Rabbi Hirsch's speeches in High Methodism, social gospel of American traditionalism, evangelicalism of centrism, meaning what is it as a religion? Two, what is it as an education? But like I said, in my case, I'm less interested in institutions and more the curriculum. And three, what is the role of the philosophic and theological issues? Those will be my concerns within the course. And next time we get started on Shaddal and traditionalism.
Okay.
The materials for what? Okay, they should be on by tonight, the units for Unit 1. Questions?
First of all, I want to mess up my list.